Welcome in Tuesday morning. Good to have you. You know, there are some days when you just need a little extra oomph.
Buddy.
Today was one of those days for me.
I thought it was Wednesday already. I was like, Wednesday.
I stopped off and got a little espresso, a little iced coffee from Starbucks.
Okay.
And I thought, boy, that's bad. That's rough for a Tuesday. And then I come in. I see Lloyd walk in with a Red Bull.
Yeah, and watermelon.
Look, I know that game. I know the Red Bull. There are some days when you need a little extra.
Sure.
And that's where the Red Bull comes in. So I'm with you.
But I have a five-hour energy inside of the Red Bull. A watermelon five-hour energy in the watermelon Red Bull. So Lloyd, I thought I'd be bouncing off the walls in about two minutes.
If you just hear this sound, that is Lloyd buzzing in his seat.
Oh, gas. No, brakes.
Yeah. You got it, baby.
That's exactly right.
You got to bring the heart monitor in for Lloyd.
Put my Apple Watch on and make sure he's all right over there.
Oh, boy.
Lloyd's like, my beats per minute is 312.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
Let's go.
All right, yeah. So a lot to talk about today. Obviously, we get to the news of Tarek Skubal. You go back to the offseason and the arbitration, and will they re-sign him? Won't they? Well, he's on his one-year deal. He won his arbitration. And the whole thing now this season became about winning.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it isn't always, but it's Tarek Skubal's last year here. We expect. Right?
We had high expectations.
That is going to be the case.
Yes.
Because they didn't re-sign him. So now he will be a free agent in the offseason. But Tarek Skubal yesterday, we got word that he is going to have to undergo surgery on his left elbow to remove loose bodies. And it's going to sideline him for an extended period of time. I've seen reports of 3 months.
Yeah, yeah.
For Tarek Skubal.
Mm-hmm. And his elbow has been kind of locking up on him.
Locking up.
You know.
He had it the other night.
Yes.
And he wasn't able to go. And now, so now it comes to the point of, well, what are we supposed to do now? It puts the pitching rotation in a tough spot.
It does. Yes.
Here's Skubal yesterday talking about the surgery.
Been dealing with some stuff, but I thought it was progressing and getting better. Yesterday I had something that kind of was different than what I'd been dealing with, and which led to kind of having some conversations with the training staff and AJ and trying to figure out what's going on. And wasn't very comfortable pitching today. So ultimately led to kind of getting a scan and seeing what's going on. And then, you know, making the decision after that to obviously proceed and get surgery kind of as soon as possible, so that way I can be back as soon as possible.
Yeah, that rotation is going to be kind of wacky.
Jason, I walked in this morning. Jason had a box of tissues next to him. I know.
Why?
You all right?
Why?
You all right over there, kid?
God.
You know, and that's the thing, you said 3 months. Edwin Diaz, a reliever for the Dodgers, formerly with the Mets, he's recovering from the same thing that Skubal's about to go through, and it's been about 3 months. So now August 5th is your target date. That's 1 week past the trade deadline.
Of course it is.
So, you know, is anyone going to take a chance?
So if you thought about moving, well, the value goes down.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. I mean, you could still trade.
Sure.
You're not going to get the haul.
No, right.
That you would have.
No, if he was
healthy.
Good, yeah.
And you're right, though. Like, the rotation now gets wacky. Your Framber Valdez, who you paid a lot of money to, he's now going to be your ace.
Yeah.
Jack Flaherty,
which is okay. I mean, that's okay.
That's fine. Jack Flaherty needs to get it together and quick.
And we still, you know, Justin Verlander's still a wild card out there, too.
Out there, yeah.
But you're going to require more from him. You want him to be your fourth. Now you got to have him be your third.
Third, yeah.
Does this team make the playoffs?
I don't know. Not really sure. But look, offensively they found a little something.
Yeah.
Right? So they're going to have to lean on their offense, and that's going to have to be the focus.
Got to get them bats going. Got to get them.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. And then once you get into the middle innings, trying to protect that as much as possible with your relievers. But yeah, the Skubal news is a real bummer.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bummer for JB Bickerstaff.
No.
He
gets
a
contract
extension with the Pistons, and this comes after that win over Orlando. Look, he's 104-60 in his two seasons with the Pistons, and you know they won 60 games this year.
Yeah,
So the transition from them kind of starting to put things together a little bit from that, what, 14-win season?
Just a couple of years ago when they won 14 games.
To where J.B. Bickerstaff has taken them, it's been impressive. And I remember when he was in Cleveland thinking J.B. Bickerstaff is the real deal.
Uh-huh.
So he's done something with this roster that they respond to.
And this series should be a really good series with Cleveland. We played Cleveland four times in the regular season. It's a 2-2 mm-hmm. deal. We beat them twice. They beat us twice. So it should be a good game.
Yeah,
tonight
a good season. Mm-hmm. But they go game one tonight down at LCA with Cleveland.
Yes,
7 o'clock tip. NBC Sports Network and Peacock.
Okay, you gotta say where it's going to be because who knows? You know, it's a roll of the dice every time.
Correct.
Right.
It's like NBA roulette.
Yes,
you're just spinning it to find out where you're watching this thing.
Oh man, Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel is backing calls for an independent audit of vote totals from last month's Michigan Democratic Party convention in Detroit, where nominees for major statewide offices were selected. Nessel says she was alerted to issues with the voting app used during the convention, claiming it misattributed her votes and congressional district, and says she notified party officials immediately. The convention held April 19th, selected nominees including Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist for Secretary of State, Washington County Prosecutor Eli Savitt for Attorney General. But controversy has grown in recent weeks with multiple candidates now challenging results and claims emerging of misrecorded votes, voting irregularities, and missing tallies. Some officials are now pushing for an independent audit, saying confidence in the process depends on transparency and accuracy. Oh, boy. A mess.
Was this thing rigged?
That's the talk you're going to hear.
They're looking into it. Meanwhile, Iran yesterday opened fire on U.S. warships in the Middle East, and the U.S. military retaliated, destroying six Iranian small boats. These are these little boats that they'll kind of send out in groups if they want to make an attack, because, again, most of their military is gone.
Gone, yeah.
And so this is the... I believe it was Scott Bessent who said these are like gnats, right? So they're not going to significantly injure a warship.
Sure.
Right? And the U.S. Navy isn't going to allow that to happen in the first place.
Yeah.
But they're more of like a nuisance, a pester. Not that to say that they couldn't do some damage, but they destroyed six of them yesterday, according to Admiral Brad Cooper at CENTCOM.
So is the ceasefire still ongoing?
Well, this is the fragility of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, you've got 15 missiles, four drones that were deployed yesterday by Iran. So it seems like the United States, at least as of right now, their position is keeping the strait blocked, keeping that at bay, while engaging in Project Freedom, as the president calls it, to try to usher boats out of the strait. But I it seems like right now they don't want to respond militarily. Now, whether this is a one-off by Iran or we start seeing this more often, time will tell. But it was that's a violation.
That's a clear violation.
Of the ceasefire.
Sure.
But not to say that the United States won't respond. It's just as of right now, it sounds like they're going to just let this play out, continue to apply the economic pressure, and see where that takes them.
And a small earthquake was felt across parts of southeast Michigan yesterday evening. The U.S. Geological Survey reports a magnitude 2.7 quake struck near Carlton in Monroe County about 5:30 yesterday afternoon. The tremor occurred at a depth of about 5.2 kilometers, and residents across Metro Detroit reported feeling light shaking. While no damage or injuries were reported, the quake was noticeable enough to briefly startle people in the area. This comes just days after a slightly stronger magnitude 2.9 earthquake hit near Amherstburg, Ontario, April 26. That quake also felt across parts of the region, highlighting a recent uptick in minor seismic activity around the Detroit River area.
Did you feel it?
I didn't feel anything yesterday. I didn't know it was an earthquake. I didn't feel anything. I have felt them before. I told you about the one when I was here years ago and the Fisher Building swayed,
mm-hmm.
And that was an Ontario earthquake, and I could feel it, but I didn't feel this one yesterday.
this explains why I did such a poor job pitching at my son's baseball game yesterday. Oh, you... That's what happened. I just,
swaying.
It's not me. It was the earthquake.
Gotcha.
That's had that. All right. Has to
Put
be
it on
what
something.
Happened.
Yeah.
Mallory McMorrow's past comments on social media have come back. Do they hurt her? We'll talk about it on the other side on JR Morning. So new tension in this primary race for U.S. Senate here in the state of Michigan. A report surfaced on CNN highlighting these roughly 6,000 tweets that were deleted by State Senator Mallory McMorrow, who's running for U.S. Senate. She would say she would disparage this part of the country,
yeah.
The Midwest. Uh-huh. She would praise California. She included all kinds of different remarks about Donald Trump, things like that. And this is when all of these candidates, whether it's Abdul El-Sayed, Haley Stevens, or Mallory McMorrow, are trying to jockey for position here.
Yes.
Because this is a pretty hotly contested race.
Tight race, yeah.
I want to play you a little bit of audio, something that Mallory McMorrow said on Sunday on CNN with Manu Raju. She talked about, she had reposted or retweeted a tweet that said, no, it's not that Midwesterners don't understand, or it's not that the coastal elites don't understand the Midwesterners. It's the Midwesterners that don't understand the coastal elites.
I think we all need to understand each other better. Trump has succeeded in weaponizing us against each other, convincing us that we are each other's enemies. I've lived all over the country. I've met a lot of different people, and I stand by that. Was it the most eloquent tweet I've ever tweeted? No. I've tweeted thousands of times.
Caitlin Buss is the assistant editorial page editor with the Detroit News, did a piece on this and joins us this morning. Caitlin, good morning. What struck me most about that particular interview on CNN was, if you go back to 2024, what was the narrative? Well, it's that the bookends of the country don't get the middle. They don't understand it. And Mallory McMorrow, even after this old tweet resurfaces, she's doubling down on that. That to me was remarkable. Is Caitlin,
you know,
there you go. Sorry, Caitlin. Oh, we got you now. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. You know, when this first hit, you know, she's roughly, and I've been, you know, around Mallory McMorrow for, you know, a long time. She's certainly been around here in Southeast Michigan. But when this surfaced, you know, I kind of thought, okay, she's a millennial candidate. You know, lots of us have social media. We've had it for years and years. You know, I kind of tried to get it. And I see your point, you know, as I was a normal person making normal tweets. But no, she was never a normal person. She's always been, as far as I've known her, angling, you know, for office. And what I also thought was interesting is the tweets didn't reveal anything necessarily new about her. Mm-mm. It just pushes back on the message she's trying to send now. We know that she has, you know, progressive tendencies. She's voted that way as a state senator. She's been very supportive of the, you know, gender ideology, some of the more woke policies. But lately she's tried to rebrand more as a centrist to, you know, get through that general election should she get there. So I don't know that this is a huge problem for her in the primary. The Democratic primary is kind of a mess. And those voters, you know, tend to be farther left. But this is definitely bad should she make it through to the general. You know, like I said, I thought it was her deplorables moment. I mean, it just kind of laid bare everything she really thinks about Michigan, you know, the middle of the country, this old debate that's been going on. And now she doesn't know what to say about it. But like you said, she doubled down on it. So I think that's an off-putting message for Michigan voters for sure.
Caitlin, can a candidate recover from a perception of condescension, or does that tend to stick with you?
You know, it obviously stuck with Hillary. I think Mallory is very different, you know, in a sense from her in that she's more up and coming. She's kind of the newer Democratic establishment versus the old. I think she can recover from this. I don't think it will tank her campaign necessarily. But, you know, she was already kind of polling in the last poll a bit behind. So we'll see what happens here. That Democratic base is so all over the place right now. I just don't know where this will land.
Interesting. Caitlin Buss, thank you for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. Interesting piece in the Detroit News. Thank you.
All right, thanks, guys.
Yeah, you got it. Here was the other a couple other things that she said. When Manu Raju asked her about these old tweets, you know, things like, it's too cold in Michigan, I hate Michigan, blah, blah, blah,
yeah.
Right? She says, well, look, I wasn't in office then. I was just a person. I was working in the auto industry. I was a designer. I was this and that. And I was just doing everything else that everybody else does.
I am not somebody who wanted to be in office or wanted to be in Congress when I was in diapers. I started my career as a car designer, and then I worked in a very different career and wasn't thinking about it. I tweeted normal things like a normal person, and people are desperate for authenticity. So that is what we need in November.
I don't mind that. I'll be honest.
Okay.
I like that. Now, whether she believes that or not, and by the way, we did reach out to Mallory McMorrow and try to get her on the show this morning. Mm-hmm. She was busy.
Declining.
I appreciate that message. Now, whether she believes that or not, whether she's just using that as cover for this issue is another story. But I appreciate that thought, because I think when you go back and you try to cancel people for tweets that they did, that they, you know, sent out 6 years ago, I think it can be ridiculous, unless it's really egregious.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I can at least appreciate that sentiment.
Well, didn't she send out a wasn't one of her tweets, didn't she say something about cars are dead?
Cars are dead, yes.
You know, now, here it is. That's our industry here in Michigan, mm-hmm. and you're saying those kind of things. I mean, to me, you know, that kind of, I would think that resonates beyond politics and kind of into the culture.
Well, here was another thing that she had tweeted again, and Manu Raju asked her about this, is the comparison between the Trump administration and Nazism.
Yeah, I do. It is deeply concerning that we see an authoritarian slide, and as we talked about earlier, dividing people against each other to convince people that if you're not doing well economically, it's somebody else's fault, is an incredibly dangerous place for us to be in. I don't think that a lot of people would argue that there are shades of authoritarianism here that we need to be deeply concerned about.
So she doubled down on that
mm-hmm.
as well. And this is another, like, I don't know. I mean, she's obviously trying to appeal to the Democratic base.
Yeah.
That's who she's courting right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is nonsensical to me. I mean, if you truly believe, either you are ignorant to what happened in history with the rise of Nazism in the Third Reich and what that actually looked like
yeah,
mm-hmm. compared to what this administration is about, then you're on a different world. That either you don't know the history and you're comparing something that you don't know, or you're lying, you're pandering to people.
I just think now she's got to try to convince voters which version of her is the real one.
800-859-0957. I think this hurts her, not in the primary.
No, absolutely not, no.
Because, again, this is the pool you're swimming in.
That's right.
Right? You're swimming in the Democratic base. You're swimming in with those voters. You're trying to get their support to then get you to the
general.
To November.
Yeah.
I think the underlying issue here is that they are... they're still confused about how to message, how to get people support. And I think that's the problem.
Kind of all over the place.
Is you go back to 2024, I'm still not entirely sure they actually know what's going on. You go back to the 70s as well, the gas issues then.
Yeah.
Are we seeing correlations? And what are the long-term ramifications of sky-high gas prices? We'll talk about that. Coming up on the other side, it's Share Morning. Well, you remember the oil shocks of the 70s?
Yeah, I was what,
you were little.
10.
You were a little guy. You weren't concerned about how much it cost to fill up the tank of mom and dad's car.
I just wanted to know if we were going on a trip.
Right.
We're going on a road trip. That's it.
Well, if you ask some experts, it's given them shades of that era because gas prices rose. And what happened? Mm-hmm. The U.S. auto industry, particularly the Detroit automakers, took a bath.
Yeah, they sure did.
It was a really rough time for the automakers. And what we're seeing now with the war in Iran, with the Strait of Hormuz and the gas prices rising again, could there be the ripple effects of how the gas prices and the prices that continue to linger at a much higher dollar amount than many of us would like, how does that then translate to the profits and profitability of our Detroit automakers? Paul Snyder is the chair of transportation design at the College of Creative Studies in Detroit and joins us this morning. Paul, good morning. It's good to have you.
Hey, good morning, guys.
It's hard to compare the situations because obviously times are a little different now, but what can we take from that time in the 70s, early 70s, and what can we learn from that into what we're seeing today?
Yeah, it's pretty hard to compare because, you know, back in the day, back in the 70s, the Detroit 3, they were working on some smaller cars, but I think without the enthusiasm that they do it today. And what I mean by that is like global cars. Mm-hmm. Everything has gone multinational now. So, you know, Ford, GM, Stellantis, they have studios all over the world. And they're working on small cars that they could import, but, you know, the sales just are not here in the U.S. Everybody's driving really large, heavy vehicles. And so the tendency is for people to want to feel safer and driving a really heavy, big vehicle themselves. Mm. So that's why we have all the SUVs on the road.
And are trucks and SUVs just so embedded in American culture that now even high gas prices won't shake that?
Well, yeah, I think so. But I do think that every time there is a, you know, an oil shock or a bump in gas prices, that people start looking for alternatives. It's pretty amazing that, you know, every time this happens, there is an uptick in more efficient vehicles, and people tend to take fewer trips, you know, summer vacations with their car and things like that when prices go up. So, yeah, as an economy across the country, we're all very price sensitive, especially right now. Mm. But, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, the United States is the world's largest oil producer now. And that's a juxtaposition to what happened in the 70s going into the 80s. But now you mentioned the global aspect of the industry. Now things are so much more global, and the whole industry in and of itself is fighting not just within North America or the United States, but globally. So how do they, being particularly the big three Toyota companies like that, how do they look at what's happening now, and do they continue to evolve or change their strategy based on these prices that linger too high?
Well, you know, nobody has a crystal ball in the glass houses at the, you know, at the top of these companies. Some of them are more prepared than others, and some of them have a deeper lineup that they could more easily import or start selling in the U.S. But when things like, you know, the decimation of all the EV mandates and infrastructure plans for electric vehicles changes overnight with a new administration, then, you know, as you know, a lot of the local industry has kind of lost billions in the last year just because of that change in strategy. But like, and I think Americans were warming up to the EVs, but, you know, we have to wait now.
Yeah, you know, because in the 70s, you know, the answer was smaller gas-powered cars. But, like, do the EVs kind of represent a kind of structural shift that small imports did, you know, back then in the 70s?
I think so. You know, there was a lot of concern about range anxiety originally. And, you know, we need infrastructure for that to be mitigated. You know, in the 70s, it was, despite the fact that, you know, Detroit had been pumping out cars for, you know, 20, 30 years already, you know, in a solid market that was buying pretty much everything they could make. That one was a bit different because, you know, Americans in general, aside from a few Volkswagens and Toyotas and Nissans or Datsuns back then running around, everybody was pretty much concerned or happy with their big vehicles, the country could accommodate for that. But since then, you know, the 70s and 80s, they saw a lot of different variety and a lot of, you know, much broader mix of vehicle types in the marketplace, and people were warming up to more efficient vehicles, and they became more accustomed to price spikes and then, you know, coming back down and then price spikes. But, you know, the sort of birth of the SUVs came when oil prices crashed in the late 80s.
Right.
It's really cheap.
It is an interesting kind of look back and how they differ and how they compare in situations like this. Paul Snyder, thanks so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure, guys.
Yeah.
Have a good one.
And, you know, here's the other part, too, is gas prices right now. I mean, sure, if you are in the market right now for a car, maybe it's going to influence the way that you buy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think for most people that's the case. Maybe you got a little buyer's remorse if you picked up a big vehicle. Yeah. You're like, boy, gas gets up to $5. It's tough to fill this thing up.
Yeah.
But the cost of these vehicles are already a problem. Right. Even before all of this. I mean, the cost of these vehicles have risen and risen and risen.
Mm-hmm.
But they're tech-filled. They've got a ton of different stuff, new safety features, things like that. And it's just – it's become more costly to produce. And so you start to layer these issues on. Gas prices are high. Cost of the vehicles are too high. So I imagine that will influence how people buy.
Well, I'm wondering if this –
in the near term.
I'm wondering if this kind of moment is going to accelerate, you know, EV adoption in the same way that oil shocks accelerated fuel efficiency back in the 70s.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I think it's a fair one.
Yeah.
But if that $75,000 or $7,500 tax credit or whatever it was, the subsidy to get these EVs,
yeah.
I think if that was still around, it might sway some more people.
Sure.
I don't know, though. I haven't seen, like, a tremendous amount of more EVs on the roadway because the infrastructure is still lacking.
Yeah.
You know, now you're going to have to put a charger in your home. I don't know.
You see more hybrids though, maybe?
I do see more hybrids.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Definitely more hybrids.
Sure. Yeah.
But outright EVs, I wonder. It's a good question. And maybe there's a delay effect here, right? If this continues on for
like a couple of months or some months. Yeah.
Maybe. Again, yeah. And it's going to affect a very small segment of people. You have to be in the market right now.
Right.
For a vehicle.
Yeah.
But I think maybe you could also think down the road, like, boy, if something like this happens again, what do we do?
Prepare yourself, yeah.
The I word is back. We'll tell you what that is. Patrick Anderson's next on JR Morning. Well, and with the cost of oil rising the way that it has, inflation risks have intensified. The Fed at its meeting last week held interest rates steady, but Austin Goolsbee, the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, said that this split decision, it was an 8-4 vote. It was mm-hmm. the most divided vote since 1992. It's not a vote you see very often at the Fed level. But he said that particular decision said that it shows that there are complications going forward in how to craft the monetary policy, particularly at the Fed level. And as a result, could we see an inflation spike at some point? Patrick Anderson is the principal and CEO of the Anderson Economic Group and joins us. Patrick, good morning. It's good to have you. Do you agree with this, that inflation, the chance of it rising here goes up as the cost of fuel continues to rise?
Absolutely. The Chicago Fed president here is saying the truth. When you have a war like this, and you have restrictions on energy supply, and you're forcing people to make very difficult choices, particularly in Europe and Asia, and even in the United States, we're insulated compared to the rest of the world. But, you know, looking at your gas bill, and it's $100, or it's $90, or it's $80, and you're used to $60, and you're doing that once or twice a week, that's painful for people. So, mm-hmm. yes, energy prices going up does in fact mean that you're going to see inflation as we calculate it go up, and it's going to mean that inflation as we feel it goes up too.
And Patrick, the Fed keeps coming back to that 2% inflation target. At what point does the Fed have to just accept that inflation might settle higher than 2%?
I hope they never accept that, Lloyd. I mean, that's part of the reason we got a Federal Reserve, is to say that's not acceptable. We're not just going to allow ourselves to become one of the many, many failed countries that let inflation deteriorate their society as well as their economy. So I hope they stay on that. And one of the great achievements we've had since the days of Ronald Reagan was getting inflation back down. I mean, at one point it seemed like, you know, like we're never going to get back to where we should be, and we're just going to give up. And that's one of the great achievements, I think, of the Reagan era was, no, we're not going back into malaise. We're going to be a great country. It's not just Ronald Reagan, but it was also Paul Volcker, who was appointed by Jimmy Carter,
uh-huh.
and a whole series of people since then. So, no, I don't want us to accept that we can't keep our inflation under control.
Yeah, and Goolsbee said that. He said we have to have assurances that we're going to get to that 2% point. So trying not to settle above that, according to him. The 8-4 vote there's obviously some disagreements on how to handle this, on whether these rates should be cut, trying to get people to spend more. Is that the way out of this?
Well, the 8-4 vote here, which you properly identified there, Chris, is highly unusual. Indicates that the committee that we have in the United States that settles on monetary policy is in fact split, and not in two directions, in three directions. We have some folks that really think, I'm reading the way they're looking at things, I think we should lower interest rates in the short term. Some people say, hey, we need to fight inflation, and some people say, let's just stay where we are. That's quite unusual.
And by fighting inflation, you mean raising the interest rate?
Yes, that's what I mean. Hmm. And if you look at what the Fed governors are saying, and what Goolsbee's saying, he's saying, hey, we have to watch this inflation. It just spiked up from 2% to 3%, and it's not going down while we have these energy price shock facing us. So, yeah, that's what he's suggesting.
And we're also looking at that leadership shift, too. Jerome Powell moving to the governor's role and Kevin Warsh stepping in. How significant is that transition?
Oh, it's certainly significant. Now, I applaud Powell. I mean, on this show, many times I criticized the Powell Fed for going along with this false narrative that that inflation was transitory. But over his tenure of his career and now in the close of his days as a chairman, he's upheld himself properly and done his job as the Federal Reserve chair, maintaining the independence of the Fed, which is to a great worth to all of us. So I'm glad he's going to stay on. I also am looking forward to Kevin Warsh. I mean, this is a very, very smart a man who also has been ringing the alarm bells about the huge expansion of the Fed's balance sheet. And so I'm glad we're going to have a new leadership there at the Fed, and I think it's a good thing for the United States.
Patrick Anderson, the sage advice, as always. We appreciate your time. Thank you, sir.
All right.
See you, yeah. Patrick.
Good to talk to both of you.
You too.
Meanwhile, Kalshi, have you dabbled on Kalshi?
No, I haven't.
The prediction market?
No.
So they're rolling out new rules and safety regulations aimed at preventing miners from trading. I've gone on it. I've perused it.
Okay.
It kind of became popular during the last presidential election.
Uh-huh.
And the problem here is there's different political and regulatory scrutinies that are all over this thing. But Kalshi's looking at age verification and monitoring tools to make sure that these younger users, particularly ages 18 to 20, aren't involved. They don't have the depth of knowledge. Not all, of course. Some are very smart.
Kids. Yeah, some are. Yeah.
But for the most part, that they don't get involved, and so particularly the minors is what they're worried about.
Mm-hmm.
So these concerns that these kids are getting on the marketplace and trading money and putting money out there that they don't necessarily have.
Well, I mean, you know, these digital platforms have struggled a lot of times with verifying age. We know that these fake IDs and shared accounts and, you know, these weak verification systems, they kind of make it easy for these underage users to get through. I mean, so what the question is, you know, whether Kalshi's new steps are going to actually be effective in keeping these young people off. I know what they want to do, but, you know.
Do you think it could be effective?
I hope it can. Let me put it that way. I mean, hope it can be effective.
I think it can be effective as, you know, like you mentioned, the shared accounts on social media.
Media, yeah.
You know, if a parent signs off on it and you're, you know, 14, well, then that's a different set of circumstances.
Exactly.
You're gaming the system, even though that's what the companies are trying to push back on. Now, they've been pushed to that point.
Uh-huh.
They've been pushed to the brink to try to make some of those changes.
Yeah.
But that's where the workaround comes in, and you know, if a kid tells his parents, I got a great idea here. If you give me $100, you know, you sign me up for this Kalshi account, I'll be able to turn that into $1,500, whatever it is.
Right, right.
You know, and maybe the parents let the kids do that, but they're trying to push back on it, which I appreciate. I don't think kids should have access to these types of platforms.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, they're you know, platforms that they can be and that they can't be.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get it.
Big Pistons game tonight, 7 o'clock hour next. 7 o'clock hour, good to have you. We got some good news and some bad news. The good news is the Pistons are on tonight.
Yes, they are, against Cleveland down at LCA.
7 o'clock tip. Got to get this thing started on the right foot.
And JB, feeling good this morning. I got to Imagine.
JB's feeling good. He gets a contract extension.
Yeah.
The details have not yet been released.
Not so good if you're in Orlando.
Not so good if you're in Orlando. Their coach gets the axe.
Yes.
Well, I don't, you know, you can't give up, or you can't only score 19 points in game six and then lose game
seven. At home,
seven.
And you're up 3-1.
Up 3-1. Yeah. That's a tough look.
Kind of hard.
Yeah, tough look. But JB Bickerstaff gets a new contract. Pistons are on tonight. Very exciting times down at LCA.
Yeah.
At least one of the teams that are playing there is holding up their end of the bargain. meanwhile.
What do you say? Tell us what you're saying, Chris.
The Red Wings have a long way to go. Meanwhile, Tarek Skubal, the bad news is he's going to be out. He's going to undergo elbow surgery. He's got some things in there that he's got to get out, and it's going to keep him sidelined for quite some time. Jason mentioned another pitcher in Major League Baseball is going through the same thing. It's about 3 months. And whether or not that's his trajectory, we'll see. There's been no timetable set for his return, but he's going to miss some significant time.
And what does that mean for our pitching rotation right now?
It means that they're going to have to step up.
Yeah.
It means you're going to need better outings from Jack Flaherty. You're going to need better outings from, you know, Casey Mize, you know, guys like that who
Verlander.
Are already dealing with injuries. Verlander dealing with an injury. So,
yeah.
You know, Framber Valdez gets brought in. He's going to be now your ace, where he was a tremendous number two. But it's going to put more strain on the starting rotation. It's going to put a lot more strain on the middle relievers. And offensively, they're going to have to
the bats
get
got to
after
go.
It.
The bats got to start.
Yeah, they're going to have to get after it. But interestingly enough, the crazy world of all of this is in the offseason, you had the arbitration with Tarek Skubal. Mm-hmm. They offered him a contract. He didn't want it. It wasn't, I mean, it seemed pretty low for what market value was going to be for him. But he wins arbitration, so he makes a little extra dough, but they don't have him signed to a long-term deal. This is his last season, and it seems the mindset was you go out and get Framber Valdez, you go out and get Justin Verlander, those kind of shore up your rotation.
Yeah.
And now you're back-to-back Cy Young winner, your ace is going to be sidelined for a couple of months here, and that's going to be problematic. So they're going to have to pick up the slack.
City and county leaders in Southeast Michigan are launching this new push to prevent gun-related tragedies involving kids. Now, yesterday, Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy introduced an audio campaign urging residents to securely store firearms. Worthy says in more than a decade of cases, her office has seen guns left in cribs, couches, kitchens, even children's play areas. She says CDC data shows firearms are now the leading cause of death for children in the United States. And in her cases, 91% of unsecured guns were loaded. Detroit Mayor Mary Sheffield backing a 6-point safety storage plan, while community leader Maurice Hardwick, we call him Pastor Mo, says gun locks can save lives and prevent stolen weapons from being used in other crimes. Officials say the 2024 law is now helping prosecutors hold people accountable. You know, as much as we've talked about that, Chris, on this show, about storing your weapons, you still hear about kids getting shot with guns that are left in all these crazy places. And when the prosecutor starts talking about guns being left in cribs and couches and kitchens, I mean, come on.
That's just not responsible.
It's just not.
It's just not responsible. And you are not a responsible gun owner.
No.
If you're leaving a loaded gun in a crib.
Yes. And what do you think? Oh, well, you know, my kid's not going to touch it. They're not going to bother it. That happens to other people. It doesn't happen over. No.
Yeah, no, that is scary.
It is,
to say the least.
And it's a shame we have to even do this.
Or you get the situation like out at Oxford with Ethan Crumbly.
Exactly.
I mean, those guns were not properly stored. They were put away.
Yeah.
But they weren't properly stored.
No.
They're not in a lockbox or kept in an area where only the owner has the ability to access them. Mm-hmm. That's not the case.
No.
And so, yeah, it's a major issue. You're just not a responsible gun owner in that case.
No.
Meanwhile, Iran opened fire on U.S. warships in the Middle East yesterday. The U.S. military retaliated. They destroyed 6 Iranian small boats, according to CENTCOM leader Brad Cooper. The U.S. military intercepted Iranian cruise missiles and drones. And this all while this effective blockade has been put into place.
And what about this ceasefire? Is it really a ceasefire now?
Well, I it seems to me the United States is a little hesitant in trying to go with military action in response. Because economically, they're doing damage.
Oh, absolutely.
They're causing a tremendous amount of havoc for Tehran.
Yeah, no, they're losing boatloads of money every day.
Yeah, so it feels like they're content with that at the moment. Now, is that a violation of the ceasefire? It sure seems like it. Sure seems like it.
It seems like it to me. And, you know, if you're firing on ships and firing on people and trying to, you know, damage ours with those little boats that we end up taking out, you know.
Yeah.
The little gnats, as they say.
Yeah. I didn't feel the earthquake yesterday.
I didn't feel it either, but there was a small earthquake felt across parts of southeast Michigan yesterday evening. The U.S. Geological Survey reports the magnitude 2.7 quake struck near Carlton in Monroe County at about 5:30 yesterday. The tremor occurred at a depth of about 5.2 kilometers, and residents across Metro Detroit reported feeling some light shaking. While no damage or injuries were reported, the quake noticeably enough to briefly startle some people in the area. I didn't feel it.
You guys feel it, Brian? Do you feel it? You're where are you? You're downriver, right? Yeah. You didn't feel it. No, he says he didn't feel it.
No.
What time did it hit?
5:30.
5:30.
P.M.?
Yeah.
Yes.
That was asleep.
Oh.
So you that sucker could have been shaking the walls. And he would have
so I might have felt it, but I don't know.
Bev's in the living room just bracing for dear life.
He's like,
Brian sawing logs. 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. This morning on the Business Beat, we ask the question, what are you worth? What? That's right. What are you worth? Well, that can be answered, of course, in a lot of different ways, but in the context of business, specifically when it comes to your value, the average value of a U.S. citizen in the advertising world, you're worth this. According to a recent report that analyzes and estimates the annual advertising value that people generate for Google's ad platform, the average U.S. consumer generates about $1,605 per year in advertising value. Proton, a Switzerland-based technology company focused on privacy, published the report last week, which draws on more than 54,000 demographic profiles and applies real cost per click data from live advertising campaigns to assign a dollar value to each of us. By putting a price tag on U.S. citizens, the report aims to highlight the financial value of personal data and the value of that data to advertisers. Applying real advertising auction benchmarks to each archetype determined the cost per click figures reflecting live market rates drawn from aggregated, anonymized pricing data across active campaigns. That is, what advertisers actually pay to reach each of these demographic profiles in Google's auction system. Interestingly, the top 10% of profiles, those are heavy desktop users, generate 43% of all value for advertisers. During the span of a decade, the average American represents nearly $16,050 in advertising value, and the most monetized profiles can reach as high as $180,000 across that time period. So there you go. Should you be feeling a little down or worthless today by chance, just know that at the very least, in the context of advertising value anyway, you're worth a cool $1,065. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
7 o'clock tip tonight down at LCA. You can watch it at NBC Sports Network or Peacock. The Cleveland Cavaliers are in town for round two of this playoff. And look, I feel much better. I feel much better going into this series than I did about halfway through that Orlando series.
Yes, definitely. And hopefully, wouldn't it be great if we can, you know, keep home court and win both of our games here at LCA?
Hunter Patterson is a staff writer covering the Detroit Pistons for The Athletic and joins us this morning. Hunter, it's good to have you.
Good morning. I appreciate y'all having me.
So these two teams were really good during the regular season. The Cavaliers made some trades at the deadline. They got better. And as a result, I think we're buckling up for a good one here.
Yeah, I think it should be a great series, another physical series, and one that probably will go, I think, at least six or possibly seven games.
How important, you know, as even though it was scary as I don't know what, how important was it for the Pistons to go through what they went through with Orlando going into this series now with Cleveland?
I'd say it was extremely important. They were, this group obviously is only in their second experience as just going through postseason ups and downs, and Jalen Duren obviously went through the rigors of being game plan four as a second option, and I think he'll be better for it going into this second round. But it's a team that just thrives in adverse situations, and it's obviously they don't want to be in those situations, but it seems like they really bond and kind of band together when they really need to. And Cade is someone who finds pressure as essentially a privilege in a way. So he just enjoys big moments and always seems to bring his best in those moments.
I mean, Tobias Harris is always pretty steady. You know, he had a wonderful game seven. But when you look at when they're at their best, Cade is asserting dominance. Ausar Thompson is defending, is stealing, and Jalen Duren is that outlet pass that always finds, you know, he always finds himself a little open space there in the paint. Is that what it's going to take against Cleveland here?
Yeah, I think part of the challenges that they overcame in that first round were about kind of rediscovering what made them a 60-win team. And you can't allow offensive rebounds, which they were doing a decent amount through the first few games against the Magic. You can't turn the ball over. And when you limit those two areas, you force teams to play against one of the best defenses in the league over the last 2 years in the half court that a lot of teams have difficulty scoring against. So I think it's really just about limiting those two areas, not giving the Cavaliers an opportunity to have multiple possessions. And from there, you just turn defense into offense. And I also think that the Pistons are going to have an easier time scoring on the Cavaliers just because there are more players you can target, essentially. Donovan Mitchell isn't the best defender. James Harden isn't really the best defender. But obviously, front court, you have a defensive player of the year in Evan Mobley and Jared Allen, who's one of the best rim protectors in the league. So I think it'll be a fun matchup, but they've rediscovered what made them the best team in the East, and that should carry them in this series.
You expect this to be a fast-paced, kind of high-scoring series or more of a grind-it-out battle?
I think this is going to be a slugfest. This is for people who prefer old-school hoops, physicality, low-scoring games. I think this will be the series for them.
Well, we're very excited about it, and we're just looking to get this thing started tonight. Can't wait till 7 o'clock. Hunter Patterson, thanks so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
Of course. I appreciate y'all having me.
Yeah, you got it.
And I think, too, you know, what's just as important, especially tonight, is the sixth man, which is the fans.
Well, yes.
You know?
Yes.
I think that's huge as well.
I am looking forward to the Danis Jenkins and Dennis Schroeder
yes.
matchup
yes.
coming off the bench,
uh-huh.
those two guards. Dennis Schroeder was on this team last year.
Yes.
You know, so I don't know. That's another fun little matchup that I like to look for. But he's right. I mean, defensively, they're not the same type of team as Orlando was.
No.
And they're not going to run you off the ball like Orlando did.
Mm-mm.
And so it's a different matchup, but you know, you just cannot look past James Harden. You know,
that's the
very
thing.
Consistent. Donovan Mitchell's going to get you 20, you know, he's going to get you 25, yeah. 20, 25 points
sure.
a game. James Harden right in that area too. So these guys can be incredibly difficult to handle offensively.
Well, you know, Cade, of course, you know, has to do his thing, which he will, but we need Tobias and those other guys, JD, to really step up as well. And I think if you have those guys, you know, hitting on all cylinders, it's just tough to beat us.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, overseas, the Iranian regime opened fire on U.S. warships in the Middle East. The United States retaliated. They destroyed six of these small boats. There were a number of missiles fired, drones that were launched as well. And this all goes to what is happening in the Strait of Hormuz, this blockade that's being put into place, applying a tremendous amount of economic pressure. I think this has been, whether they planned it or not, because I'm not entirely sure the plan was to put the blockade in place.
No.
I mean, let's just call a spade a spade. I don't believe that was the plan going in.
No, and I don't think they thought that Iran was going to start blocking.
Well, I don't. Yeah, there were those reports that said that that was a concern, that they were going to, you know, put these mines down, or they were going to start firing from the coast, and that was going to be a problem for a lot of the travel in the waterway. Whether they expected them to actually do it or not is a different story.
Right.
But I think they thought it was a possibility. I don't think the Iranians thought it was a possibility that the United States was going to put a blockade in place.
Now, that is true.
And I don't think the United States thought that they were going to. I don't know that that was ever part of the plan. I have no way to know. I know it came late, though.
Yeah.
It came much later after, you know, the threats that the United States was levying at Tehran to, you know, get these mines out of the water, to open the waterway, provide safe passage. That was after all of that rhetoric.
And people are, you know, are still a little confused because on one hand, you hear the president say, you know, talks are going well, things are going well. And then the next moment, he's like, we're going to blow them out the water and just, you know, annihilate them. So it's like, well, what's and it's like every it could be the same day in the morning. Things are going well. In the afternoon, we're going to blow them away. And people don't know, like, where are we really in this?
I don't think we have an answer to that. I don't think we have an answer to that. It seems obvious to me that the United States is willing to forego military action at this point.
Yeah.
If you haven't struck back at now, then I think that they're trying to go the diplomatic route.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're trying to keep the blockade in place and go the diplomatic
route. Because they're choking them out with the blockade.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely they are. Coming up on the other side, Bill Ballinger joins us. There is a special state election to replace Kristen McDonald Rivett. It takes place today. We'll talk about it next. So, JR Morning. Well, there's a lot of local issues to vote on today all around the state of Michigan. There is one also in the area, the Saginaw area, Midland, Bay City, things like that.
Without representation for a pretty good while there.
They have been senatorless.
Yes.
Since Karen McDonald Rivett elected to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in early 2025. So it's been a very long 16 months.
Sure.
And there has been those clamoring in the communities to have that state leadership. The governor has said multiple times that they've been able to be covered. They can call offices, things like that. It's not their voices haven't been heard, but they haven't been able to actually cast votes on who would be representing them. And that's on the ballot today. Who's on the ballot? Democrat Cedric Green, Republican Jason Tooney. Ollie Sleds is the Libertarian on the candidate. But up for grabs is control of the Michigan Senate.
Sure.
And part of that, there could be serious ramifications for laws that are being bandied about in Lansing. Let's talk about it. Bill Ballinger is the owner of the Ballinger Report and joins us this morning. Bill, it's good to have you back.
Great to be here.
This has been a hotly contested seat for quite some time, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. As you point out, 16 months, a record amount of time where there's been no representation. It's a tragedy. In my view, it should not happen. The governor has the power to call the election anytime she or he wants to. But this is a record amount of time, 16 months, that this district has had no representation. That's an atrocity.
You know, Democrats clinging to this 19-18 majority, even with Garland Gilchrist able to break ties, how much power would a 19-19 split really give Republicans?
You're right, Lloyd. It really wouldn't give them very much. It really will not make much difference at all between now and the end of the year which party wins this race today. If it's a 19-19 Senate, if the Republicans win the race today, you know, the Republicans are not going to be able to pass anything with Garland Gilchrist as the tie-breaking vote as lieutenant governor. So it's really the importance of this race is the Democrats nationally are establishing a story, a narrative that Donald Trump is unpopular and Republicans are unpopular, and they've been winning special elections all across the country for the last 16 months. And this is a chance here in Michigan to win one here and say the same thing. they don't want the Republicans to win this and upset the apple cart, upset their narrative, and show that the Republicans actually have some life in them. They want to keep the losses piling up on the Republican side. And so that's really what this race is about today. It's not about who controls power in Lansing between now and the end of the year.
Although the politics at play here, if they're going to force Garland Gilchrist to make some of these decisions on votes, that has political ramifications because he's running for another office.
Well, first of all, if Garland Gilchrist shows up, that'll be a major story because
fair.
He has the worst attendance record of any lieutenant governor in history. But look, it really won't because if the Democrats win this seat today, they will have their majority back. 2018 that they had in 2023 and 2024. But then the Republicans won back control of the state House in 2024, and that changed everything. Because no matter what the Senate does, and no matter what the governor wants, if the Republicans controlling the House don't want it, they can block anything. So the idea that somehow Democrats winning this seat today, getting back the seat they had when McDonnell Rivett held it, is going to change anything, it isn't, because the Republicans now control right. the House, which they didn't back in 2023 and 24.
Bill, special elections, you know, they're always about turnout. Who has the advantage there?
Well, so far, the Democrats have shown they're turning out much better than Republicans. This is nationally. We don't really know here in Michigan because we haven't had a true test in the last 16 months, but we're getting a test today. And we'll find out if Republicans are motivated to get out and vote today, and for that matter, independents and ticket splitters. I think the Democrats are motivated, and I think they'll be out. Chedrick Green outspent Tunney in this race by over $1 million. So money has poured into this race, particularly from out of state, because of what I just said. The Democrats want to keep the narrative going that they're on a roll, that the Republicans are in trouble, that Donald Trump is unpopular, and they're winning these elections, and that the voters nationally and here in Michigan want to return the Democrats to power. That's the story they're trying to cement.
Bill Ballinger, always great insight. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk soon.
I hope so.
Yeah.
All right.
You got it.
Talk to you, Bill.
Interesting race out there.
And very
like
much
you
so.
Mentioned, a lot of money being spent. Meanwhile, I found this story in the Los Angeles Times. Gen Zers are taking micro trips. Mm-hmm. And in this particular case, Akilah Cox and her boyfriend took a red-eye flight from Pennsylvania to Dublin. The trip lasted less than 30 hours. Mm-hmm. They hit up a number of spots. They went to the Guinness store. They went to the Book of Kells experience at Trinity College, Haypenny Bridge, Capel Street for shopping, things like that. They went to a dinner and a show, and then were back to work on Monday. Okay. Is this something you'd be able to do?
Not me.
You flying across the world for...
Not me.
For 18 hours of being there
time.
And coming back?
I need some time. But, you know, for these, you know, Gen Zers, I mean, you know, they have limited PTO a lot mm-hmm. of times, you know, and these kind of trips just kind of fit into their schedule. They're a little cheaper. They're easier to plan. And, you know, you don't have to take off a full week. And, you know, so it works for them.
Yeah. In this case, Cox is working as a full-time engineer. She's getting her master's and her boyfriend's in medical residency. So she's like, we can't.
Yeah.
We just can't take a bunch of time off. That's just not real for us, but we like to travel. We like to go places. And this is like a new thing. And one of the trends that is showing on like Airbnb, for example, is that these younger folks are not buying Airbnbs when they travel because they're only there
for
they're not like sleeping.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's incredible. Some of the comments on these posts have been really funny too. Like, I want to be this crazy, or I'd love to, you know, do this. It does sound like a lot. It does sound like a lot. But if you're somebody that can sleep on a plane, if you're somebody that can, you know, maybe it's not. It doesn't bother you.
And
as
it
much.
Has to fit into your if it fits into your schedule because of, you know, the things that I, you know, said. You know, these limited gig based schedules, limited PTO. I mean, you know, these people, these Gen Zers, they prioritize I think memories over extravagance.
800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. That's there for you. Would you take a micro trip? Would you go to Dublin for 30 hours? Hit a couple of spots, come home, be to work on Monday. They left Friday night, took a red eye Friday night, back to work on Monday. You know what cocktails they had on the trip?
What did they have?
Red Bulls and 5-Hour Energies mixed together.
They had my cocktail?
No, Bryce.
That's what they had.
They had a Lloyd cocktail?
They had a Lloyd cocktail. Any booze in there?
No, they had to. They had to have some. Yeah.
This is the greatest Guinness I've ever had in my life. Paul W. Smith is off on his Pure Michigan tour. We're going to talk to ITC Michigan next. That's coming up on JR Morning. Well, our Paul W. Smith is out and about on his Pure Michigan tour.
Yeah.
Some of the great broadcasts every year. I look forward to listening because they're always just that awesome places, fun places.
He was at Mackinac yesterday, I believe.
Mackinac yesterday. I saw him getting some ice cream.
Big old ice cream cone.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's tremendous. But it's kind of the kickoff start to the part of the calendar where we get to go out and enjoy the weather, enjoy the beaches, enjoy the sights and scenes and the smells and the tastes.
And see what we have to offer here in Michigan.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And it wouldn't be possible without our friends at ITC Michigan. Julie Burrell's the area manager and joins us this morning. Julie, it's good to have you.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Well, we always appreciate your partnership. And let's talk a little bit about ITC, what you guys are doing now, what you're doing in the company.
Yeah, for sure. So ITC owns and operates the high voltage electric grid, which is also sometimes called electric transmission lines, throughout the majority of Michigan's Lower Peninsula. And our work basically starts at power plants where electricity is generated, and then it gets carried through our high voltage transmission lines, normally over fairly long distances. And then eventually we connect to the smaller local power lines like your DTE or Consumers Energy. And those are called distribution lines that end up bringing the electricity directly to your house, my house, and businesses that we know and love. So we're essentially kind of responsible for developing, building, and maintaining all of that transmission infrastructure that holds that three-part system together, moving power from where it's generated to where it's needed, kind of like how highways do for people.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the stops along this year's WJR Pure Michigan Tour is the Heritage Museum of Newaygo County. Why did you guys select Newaygo?
Yeah, well, first, as you mentioned at the beginning there, ITC has been a longtime sponsor of the WJR Pure Michigan Tour, and we're really excited to continue that again this year. And so I don't know if you guys know where Newaygo is, or if any of your listeners know where Newaygo is, but it's about 40 minutes north of Grand Rapids. And, you know, I really think that Newaygo County is a hidden gem. It's an incredible destination, especially for outdoor enthusiasts, and it has a much shorter travel time than some of the other more widely known up north destinations.
Yeah, it's a great spot. Newaygo County, I don't get there as often as I'd like, but it is, you're right, it is a wonderful corner of our mitten. You talked a little bit about the power systems that you guys have, but the grid in particular, the energy landscape here in Michigan, I have to imagine that's a big focus for you guys at this point.
Absolutely. So a couple minutes ago, I mentioned about that kind of three-part system, the generation, transmission, and distribution. All of those are changing really, really fast. So generation is shifting. You know, as we know, we have new natural gas plants coming online, retirement of coal plants. We've even had, you know, the restart of a nuclear plant here in Michigan. And all of those changes impact how the grid operates. And then on the distribution side, of course, demand is increasing. Mm-hmm. So if you think back 20 years ago, none of us were charging multiple smartphones at home or using battery-powered lawnmowers or even listening to WJR via the internet, right? Mm-hmm. So all of those things are changing how everything operates. And then, of course, we at ITC with the electric transmission, we're at the center of all of those changes. So we have a critically important job to make sure that we're staying ahead of all of that, keeping the grid reliable so that way it performs exceptional for us today, tomorrow, and 20 years from now.
And Julie, ITC works closely with communities and landowners. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, for sure. So we work really closely with communities. So I failed to mention earlier what my role is, but one of the great things is I get to work directly with communities. So I am an area manager on our local government and community affairs team, which basically means that I'm the connection between ITC and the communities that we serve. And that can mean something different every day, like supporting a local economic development organization, attending a chamber event, or working with communities when we need to do maintenance on equipment, or maybe even when we need to build a new line. And that's, you know, really our focus is wanting to be a true partner and a good neighbor in the communities we serve. And I am lucky enough to be able to build all of those long-term relationships in 21 counties in Northwest Michigan. So,
I'm sure you've been very busy lately then with all of the talk that's going on about energy needs and demands and things like that. And just such a wonderful partnership. And we're so thrilled that ITC continues to be a main partner with Paul W. Smith and the Pure Michigan Tour.
Yeah, we're excited to continue the partnership and really excited to have him in Newaygo at the Heritage Museum today.
Awesome. Well, thank you for everything and enjoy the stop. Everybody will be listening very excitingly to hear what's going on in Newaygo County and with ITC. Julie Burrell with ITC Michigan, thanks so much. Really appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks so much. You guys have a great morning.
Yeah,
you as well.
Yeah, you do the same. Cool.
Always great to have Paul W. up there kind of showing us and telling
giving us the roadmap.
Yeah.
What we need to do this summer.
There's so many great places in Michigan. So many, you know, you don't necessarily have to leave Michigan. A lot of staycation places around here that you can really enjoy yourself. A lot of great, great places.
You know the problem that, like, we find ourselves in, particularly with the kids?
Uh-huh.
It's like we find our favorite spots, and then, like, we just kind of, it's like a magnet. Like, it just kind of pulls us back. We just kind of go to these areas. Like, we got our spots out in West Michigan, Northern Michigan, things like that.
Uh-huh.
But, like, I always think, like, let's go somewhere else. Let's go do something
else.
Because it's just, there are so many great spots that you just instantly fall in love with.
Uh-huh.
That you just want to keep going back for more. keep trying to find, you know, chasing that dragon, because it's so wonderful.
Yeah, it is.
But there's just so many great spots here in the state of Michigan, and Paul highlighting a lot of those for us on the Pure Michigan Tour. Meanwhile, Pistons getting ready tonight. Game one, series two. Cleveland on tap, 7 o'clock tip at LCA.
It's going to be a great series, I believe, because these teams really played each other hard during the regular season. Played four times. Pistons won two games. Cleveland won two games. So I think it's going to be a great matchup. I also think LCA is going to be hyped this evening, and that's going to help out as well. And we need, of course, Cade to come through, as he always does. But Cade needs some help, and we need some help from some of those other players to really make it happen. And I think if we get that help, you can't beat us.
Yeah, that help comes from Tobias Harris a lot in that series. He played pretty well.
Uh-huh.
Jalen Duren kind of found his way a little bit towards the end of that series, so that was good to see. You know what's interesting? We talked a lot about how the Orlando series helped us going forward, how it prepared us for this series against Cleveland. Well, James Harden was saying the same things. Toronto did some unbelievable things. They prepared us for Detroit. We know we're facing a really good team. They got Cade, the head of the snake, who's playing well. Tobias Harris, who's playing extremely well. We'll figure out what they like to do, figure out what we want to do, and just take it from there. So they're basically saying the same thing.
They both went seven games.
That slugfest with Toronto helped us get ready for Detroit.
Yeah, but it's not good enough. It wasn't good enough for them to get ready for Detroit. Detroit is to take them out.
I hope so.
I'm just saying.
I hope so. We were flying a little too close to the sun in a lot of that Orlando series.
We were.
So I hope.
I'm confident now.
I'm confident too. I like this matchup more.
I do.
I like this matchup more than I did the Orlando series.
Yes.
So that is helpful.
Yeah, and I like this matchup better than if we would have been playing Toronto.
How do you think Dan Gilbert feels about all this? I mean, he's wearing his Cleveland Cavaliers stuff.
Listen,
for
man.
Sure. He's the owner of the team.
I know.
I
man.
Love
it's
it.
Kind of. Hey,
he's rejuvenating Detroit. He's rejuvenating Cleveland.
He's getting a little bit of the best of both worlds,
it's,
I guess.
I think it's awesome. You what know? A wonderful predicament to be in.
I mean, come on.
It's pretty darn
that's
cool.
That's a nice side story I'm sure they're going to talk about.
Absolutely. 8 o'clock hour coming up. A lot to do. We're talking gas on the other side, too. It's Jared Morning. All right, so that's Dan Kane, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. A lot of information there from the secretary saying America is using their strengths to lift up others in the region, and that if these attacks don't stop, there will be overwhelming and devastating American firepower that the Iranian regime will face. A simple call there by the secretary, Pete Hegseth, let innocent ships go freely. He also said to our allies in the region, this is a temporary mission. They're doing this to stabilize the world, and they will be handing back responsibility to those who count on the commerce of the Strait, which I thought was pretty interesting there. Certainly for those, you know, France and many of our NATO allies that rely on that waterway for commerce, saying that you're going to have to at some point step up here, even if you don't want
Absolutely.
To now.
Yes.
At some point, you're going to need to help out here.
And he said, you know, these other allies, you know, need the Straits really more than the United States, but we're getting hit. I mean, our gas prices are still
the global impact, certainly. It's not that we require their energy, their fuel.
Right.
But the global domino effect here has been quite obvious, particularly when you head to the gas pump. So we'll keep you up to date on that. If any other interesting news comes out of that press conference, we'll surely pass it along to you. Meanwhile, the good news today is we've got Pistons basketball tonight, 7
yes,
o'clock,
sir.
NBC Sports Network, Peacock for your viewing pleasure, and just get out, just win this game.
That's
Make it 1-0
Yep.
And take care of business tonight. And you're expecting big things from the crowd, too.
I'm expecting the crowd to be crazy tonight, and it's going to be huge. And I think we need to hit the ground running, get out in front, and just keep that lead and, you know, get some help for Cade, you know, Tobias, JD, Asar Thompson. You know, we need him to get some steals and be very active, you know. And I think when you have all those hitting, it's hard to beat us.
JB Bickerstaff also got an extension yesterday. We don't know the deals of it.
No.
The terms of it, but certainly well worth it for JB Bickerstaff. He's done a wonderful job.
I mean, he's turned his team around. I mean, 14 games, remember, like 28 losses in a row, 14. I mean, we're a long way from that now. We're a long way from that now. Now, it didn't turn out the same for Orlando, which I told you yesterday. I wouldn't want to wake up in Orlando yesterday.
No.
You don't have to deal with that. And now their coach is gone.
Yeah. Tarik Skubal undergoing surgery on his left elbow. It's going to sideline him for some time, unfortunately. And A.J. Hinz talked about the surgery and what it's going to mean.
Tarik will also go on the injured list. And I kind of walked through the timeline. He's got loose bodies in his elbow, which we have determined last night. When I said no news was good news, because we didn't have any news when I was sitting here 24 hours ago. And then we, during the game, I think he had another episode of it locking up. And was uncomfortable. So we got scans on it yesterday, revealed the loose bodies, and he needs to get it taken care of. So surgery is going to happen soon.
It's going to put a lot more pressure on the starting rotation for Amber Valdez when Justin Verlander returns. So it's going to put a lot more pressure on the starting rotation. It's going to put more pressure on the middle relievers, too, certainly. And offensively, they're going to have to hit the ball.
Got to get them bats. Got to get the bats going.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And the situation in Iran continues to evolve. There were missiles launched, drones launched towards U.S. ships. Small fighter boats for the regime were approaching and fired on vessels in the region. And that's a part of the reason why this press conference was today. But this Operation Freedom, as they mentioned, is underway to try to escort boats through the Strait of Hormuz safely, and that continues to be a main focus for the United States when it comes to Iran.
Spirit Airlines is asking the U.S. Bankruptcy Court to approve millions in retention bonuses as the discount carrier shuts down operations after filing for bankruptcy. The airline confirmed it has ceased flying and says there are no longer any viable options to continue operating or reorganize. In a court filing, Spirit's chief financial officer said the company has no alternative to an orderly wind down. The airline says it lacks the funds to properly sell off aircraft, and Spirit is seeking approval for about $10.7 million in bonuses for remaining employees, averaging about $76,000 each, along with additional payments for top executives. And as we know, Spirit has been under financial strain for months, worsened by rising fuel costs and failed bailout talks. Now, listen, you want to give bonuses to the employees who are still there and the top executives. But, you know, hopefully the people who have been stranded, who paid their money, who get their refunds like they're supposed to as well.
Meanwhile, I told you about letsbuyspirit.com.
Yes.
Yesterday, letsbuyspiritair.com. I think yesterday during the show it was at $88
million. Uh-huh.
Up to this morning, $132 million.
Yeah, still a ways to go. I mean, but
Target's $1.75
billion. A little ways to go.
Got a little ways. But the average pledge size is almost $1,000. Does that surprise you?
Wow.
$934. That seems crazy to me.
That is.
Gas prices continue to rise. When can we expect a little bit of a respite? Patrick DeHaan joins us on the other side. It's Jer Morning. Well, according to AAA, the average price of a gallon of gas is...
Too much.
$4.40. In Michigan, the average cost $4.80. So beating the national average in the worst way possible.
Yes, yes.
But is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Could we see a respite on some of these prices? Might we see them come down? To talk about that, Patrick DeHaan, the head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy.com. Patrick, it's good to talk with you again.
Well, thanks for having me.
It seems like there are a lot of different factors as to why these prices have gone up the way that they have, particularly the last couple of weeks. What's contributed to that?
Well, the latest sharp increase that we saw compared to last week is really a heavy dose of refinery snags that developed. Several BP's refinery in Northwest Indiana had a unexpected power loss week before last on Sunday night, compounded by maintenance that's also happening. I think most of the time you've probably had me on in the past couple of months, we've been talking about refinery maintenance season. Well, that's happening. And when an outage like BP's happens, when other refineries doing maintenance, there's limited ability for gasoline flows to remain consistent. Not only those that refinery, but then another one outside Chicago, ExxonMobil Joliet, Marathon Refining in Robinson, Illinois, and Phillips 66 in Roxanne, Illinois. So all the refining issues, then on top of oil prices that had jumped early in the week last week after President Trump had signaled to his administration to be prepared for a longer blockade of the strait, which had sent oil prices sharply higher. So all of that is what happened at the pump, not only in Michigan, by the way. Kind of a unique circumstance. Michigan probably should have gone above $5.
Wow.
Along with Illinois. But Indiana, which has a gas tax holiday of 17 cents, went up to the exact same amount that Michigan did. So I don't think I've ever seen that. But yeah, Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois all went up to as high as they could go without hitting the $5 a gallon mark.
So, Patrick, the question I guess everybody wants to know, when do we get a break at the pump?
Well, let's look at the numbers here this morning. I think we'll start seeing a little bit of that. You know, you'd mentioned looking at our data, we're at 483 this morning, gas buddy data for a statewide average. That's down a half a penny. Don't be in a rush to really hurry and fill, although unless something happens in the strait, that could change. But right. I think we'll get a little bit of relief this week. We're at 483. It wouldn't surprise me by the end of the week that we'll probably be in the mid to upper 470s. So long as these refinery issues get sorted out, which usually happens after about a week or two, we could probably see prices fall into the mid-fours again after this, so long, again, as there's no new issues. I don't have a crystal ball, and if there's any new refining issues, of course, that could send prices back up. But hopefully some modest relief this week, but I feel foolish saying that because we're still in the upper fours, right? And even if it gets any better, it's going to be in the mid-fours, which, by the way, prices in Michigan today, $1.66 above where they were a year ago.
I want to play you something that Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said yesterday. He says that gas is expected to come down here in the next couple of weeks.
Corporate earnings are good. Employment is good. And this gasoline, this temporary aberration, will be over in a matter of weeks or a month.
Well, let's say everything stays status quo in the Strait of Hormuz at this point. Is that a realistic timeline?
Not even remotely close. I wouldn't look for gas to go under $4 this summer unless the strait reopens. And as we all have seen, Iran now launching new attacks on the UAE, that appears as unlikely as ever. Even if the strait were to completely reopen tomorrow, we're probably talking about Michigan prices that are either in the upper threes or low fours this summer. And that's going to be way, way higher than last summer when prices were in the low threes. So there's no circumstance in my mind, as this has been ongoing for 65 days, the world has missed out on a billion barrels of oil that would otherwise flow through the strait. Global inventories are declining. Even the U.S., we exported nearly 99.2 million barrels of oil and refined products left our shores in the last 7 days alone. The president's inviting countries to buy our oil. They're doing exactly that. So until Detroit reopens, our inventories are being more and more depleted. Our SPR has fallen another 5 million barrels in the last week. And that's not doing really anything to cushion the blow here. So, you know, whatever you hear out of the administration, all thoughts aside, there's really not much in my mind that we'll see prices fall like a rock or you know, fall anywhere close to where they were prior to this situation. I think at best, as I mentioned, Michigan mid to upper $3 gallon range this summer.
So drivers here should brace for more pain before any type of real relief comes on the horizon?
Well, yeah, I mean, more pain. I think the same pain they've been dealing with the last couple of weeks is not likely to disappear. I think we'll be around $4 a gallon. I would even say that into July 4 now, even under the most ideal of outcomes, we could be still close to $4 around Memorial Day. Even if the Strait reopens, we're going to be, you know, mid to upper fours by July 4, because in the backdrop, it's, you know, when the Strait reopens, if and when that happens, it's not going to happen to, you know, everyone's saying, well, when it reopens. Well, I don't know if it's just going to reopen or not in the way that we're all hoping it will. If it does, you know, maybe mid threes by the summer, or I should say by the middle of the summer. But we won't see any of those sub $3 prices showing up potentially for a year longer, because in the backdrop of those global oil inventories are declining, and it's going to take probably the better part of a year now to build those back up. And every day longer, it's going to take another week or so. So we're tacking on time to this. We're not talking about seeing, you know, those sub $2 prices that President Trump talked about in the State of the Union. You might not see that until 2027. Mm.
Patrick Tahan at GasBuddy.com. We always appreciate your insight. Thank you so much. We'll talk soon.
My pleasure.
Yeah, you got it. Interesting.
People are, you know, wanting to have, you know, get in the cars and drive. That may kick that back a little bit because of these gas prices, but they are cheaper than, I'm sure, flying on an airplane. Jet fuel is.
Yeah, it probably does benefit our local economy in the state of Michigan this summer, because people are more likely to drive somewhere, stay closer to home where you can drive.
Yeah.
And take advantage of what we've got here, you know, as Paul W. Smith on his Pure Michigan tour. This is something that I think makes more sense this summer probably than people heading out somewhere else.
I'm telling you, because those plane rides, like I said, are going to be pretty expensive.
They are expensive. Mm-hmm. And again, this is the one of the things the president has said is like, this is what we expected. That doesn't make it easier.
No,
it's not a good selling point to people who are like, wait a second, I can't afford anything before this.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the problem, and obviously that's something that they have to contend with. Pistons play tonight. We'll talk about that on the other side. Coming up on JR Morning.